Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Gas prices are at or near record highs in the U.S., and that has people's attention. What about food prices? Have you noticed them rising? Are you making different choices in the supermarket? If not, it might be because of two things. One, in America, so much of our food is processed, packaged, and marketed that raw commodity prices make up only a fraction of the price of the food we buy. In other countries, especially the less developed ones, an increase in the price of rice or corn can have a major effect on how much a family can afford to eat. Two, Americans spend only 9% of their income on food, while millions around the world spend 50 to 70%. Millions of households now routinely schedule foodless days each week, days when they will not eat at all. A recent survey by Save the Children shows that 14% of families in Peru now have foodless days, India 24%, Nigeria 27%. That's one in four families in these in those last two countries have days where they know they will go without food. In his newest book, Full Planet, Empty Plates, Lester Brown writes the following. The U.S. Great Drought of 2012 has raised corn prices to the highest level in history. The world price of food, which has already doubled over the last decade, is slated to climb higher, ushering in a new wave of food unrest. This year's corn crop shortfall will accelerate the transition from the era of abundance and surplus to an era of chronic scarcity. As food prices climb, the worldwide competition for control of land and water is intensifying. In this new world, access to food is replacing access to oil as an overriding concern of governments. Food is the new oil. Land is the new gold. Welcome to the new geopolitics of food. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The Washington Post calls Lester Brown one of the world's most influential thinkers. After working with the Department of Agriculture and International Agricultural Development, Brown helped establish the Overseas Development Council, then founded World Watch Institute, which publishes its annual State of the World report. And in 2001, he left World Watch, founded Earth Policy Institute, and continues his vital work. During a career that began with tomato farming, Brown has been honored with numerous prizes, including the MacArthur Genius Fellowship, the United Nations Environment Prize, and Japan's Blue Planet Prize. His over 50 books include Plan B, versions 1.0 through 4.0, World on the Edge, and his latest, Full Planet, Empty Plates. Welcome again, Lester Brown, to Pacifica and Free Forum.
Terrence, I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Okay. You were born in 1934, in the midst of the Depression. You graduated college in the mid-50s. Looking back, do you recall what the issues that you focus on today might have looked like to a young grad at that moment, and how you might have imagined your life and career?
Well, one of the things that happened to me right after graduation was I had an opportunity to spend half of 1956 living in villages in India. So while I had grown up on a farm, my brother and I had grown tomatoes together. I had a Bachelor of Science degree in agricultural science from Rutgers, so I was very much immersed in agriculture, and even then, particularly after spending several months living in villages in India, I was beginning to think about the world food population balance and where things would be heading. At that time, India had, I don't know, 380 million people. And its population was growing. It was already double that of the United States. And so I was beginning to think about the food population balance more than half a century ago.
Ah, very interesting. And I've mentioned at other in other interviews we've done that you were certainly ahead of the pack on that. As I have mentioned, environmental issues when they occurred were conserve this this area, you know, handle the pollution in that local water body and so on. And you, as you just said, were looking at the global issues. When you started Earth Policy Institute, as I said, early in the last decade, in around 2000-2001, you wrote, "While the environmental community has gained a well-deserved reputation for successfully opposing certain policies or initiatives that it is against, it is less clear what the community is for. Without a vision, without a sense of where we want to go, it will be difficult to get there." How have things improved, if they have, on that account?
Well, probably the most exciting thing happening in the world today is the closing of coal-fired power plants in the United States. We have a total of, or had a total of 492 coal plants, and of that number, 121 either have recently closed or are scheduled to close in the next year or two. So that's leading to a big cut in carbon emissions in the United States. I think this year, carbon emissions in coal plants will drop by 11%. So that's one of the really encouraging developments. The other source of carbon, of course, the other principal source of carbon, is oil. And here we also see gasoline use dropping now as for two reasons. One, the U.S. automobile fleet is shrinking, and that is largely because young people are not part of the car culture in the way that preceding generations were. When I was growing up at on a farm in southern New Jersey in the 1950s, getting a driver's license and something to drive, a pickup or a car or something, was sort of a rite of passage. When you reach your 17th birthday, everyone did that. That's how we socialized in a rural community. But today, young people living mostly in cities socialize over the Internet. Their cell phones have taken the place of my generation's cars. So it's an interesting shift, and it happens to be a very environmentally friendly shift. Simply because we don't have to manufacture all the cars, we don't have to produce all the gasoline. So this is an important shift in the right direction. And although the U.S. resisted signing any international agreements on cutting carbon emissions, the fact is that in the last two or three years, we have cut carbon emissions dramatically, and we will continue to do so in the years ahead.
Yeah, that note about young people not being as addicted to cars or as fascinated with cars or as focused on cars is a very interesting one. I read something recently that said cars and homes as well, and consumption in a way, that they are just less oriented that way as a generation, more oriented toward sharing, toward renting, toward all these things. And I don't know if anyone could have predicted that.
I doubt we could, because it's partly a result of the social changes of becoming a largely urban society. You know, 82% of us live in towns and cities today. But it's also part of it's a function of technology.
Yeah.
Because the cell phones and the Internet have really led to major changes, not only in communications and the person-to-person level, but even in shopping. A lot of people don't go to the mall to do the shopping anymore. They just go online and order it. That's also an energy saver.
I would think also what happens is you go online, you are less able and less likely to browse. You know, you go to a mall and it's all shiny objects, you know.
Right.
You go online to buy what you're planning to buy.
Right.
In addition to noticing new information and new trends, positive and negative, you've been looking at the same issues for half a century at least, are you having new realizations, new understanding? What's new in how you see things?
Well, the one of the things that is new and pleasantly surprising is, as I noted, the way we're cutting carbon emissions in this country. Not because of an organized government effort, though government is contributing to this. The big player in closing coal-fired power plants is the Sierra Club. They have a program they started, I think it's be 3 years ago now, called Beyond Coal. And their goal is to close every coal-fired power plant in the United States. And they're succeeding. And what this has done is also inspire others. For example, Mayor Bloomberg of New York, in July, I guess it would be July a year ago now, wrote a check for the Sierra Club for $50 million, specifically for their Beyond Coal campaign. He said, coal has to go. And it's one thing when the president of the Sierra Club says this, or I say it, but when one of the most successful businessmen of our generation says coal has to go, it has some clout. So it's interesting to see how the movement is expanding and gaining support and momentum. But I think it's pretty clear now that the coal industry is on the way out, and will be right now it's being replaced with cheap and abundant natural gas for the most part. Though wind farms are playing an important role, particularly in states like Texas, and in the Great Plains generally, Iowa and South Dakota are now each getting 20% or so of their electricity from wind farms. So we know what's possible and what we can do, and it's beginning to happen.
Yeah, it's exciting. I interviewed Ralph Nader recently, interestingly enough, you two born the same year.
That's right.
And been at this a long time. And he said that one of his new book is Solutions, 17 Solutions. And one of them is to involve the enlightened elite. That is, you know, he says the 1% includes some very enlightened billionaires. And you're pointing out what Michael Bloomberg has done in terms of the Sierra Club and coal is an example of that. And I think he's right. Go ahead.
Another of those billionaires has been very effective is Ted Turner.
Yep, absolutely, for years. In a 2002 study published, I'm reading from something you've written. In a 2002 study published by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, a team of scientists led by Mathis Vakkernagel of the Global Footprint Network concluded that humanity's collective demands first surpassed the Earth's regenerative capacity around 1980. That is to say that up until then, I'm leaving your quote right here for a moment, up until then, we consumed no more than the Earth replenished each year. But in 1980, that changed. Global demands on natural systems exceed their sustainable yield capacity by around 30%. This means we're meeting current demands in part by consuming the Earth's natural assets, the principle, if you will, setting the stage for an eventual Ponzi-type collapse when these assets are depleted. Now, in the 70s, now I'm asking the question, early environmentalists Dana Meadows and Jürgen Randers and Dennis Meadows in Limits to Growth, famously, predicted, or at least others claim they predicted, that we were running out of resources. And when we didn't run out, over the next couple of decades, critics call them alarmists. What's new about the scenarios that Mathis Vakkernagel is talking about and that you're talking about that make them more accurate or more imminent?
Well, it's interesting because it's not been many months ago that here in town they had a 40th anniversary conference organized by the Smithsonian it was the 40th anniversary of the launching of the Limits to Growth. And the Limits to Growth did was to look at the big picture and do it in a systematic way, and it was clear even then to Dennis and Dana and Jürgen Randers and so forth that we were not going to be able to sustain the economic growth that we'd experienced during the most of the century's third quarter. And there's no question about whether they're right or not. They are. And what you find today is some very knowledgeable, informed people, and including some very very wealthy people who realize that we can't continue with business as usual. We're in trouble, and the question is how do we get ourselves out of this mess? And that's when I begin to focus on things like cutting carbon emissions, which we're doing with substantial success in this country, though the world is not yet close to peaking in carbon emissions. China's building coal plants faster than we're closing them, for example.
Right.
But at least we've got the world's largest economy now, the United States, headed in the right direction.
And Germany moving, it seems to me, even quicker than we are. Germany, if not the, what are they, number three or so, or number four maybe behind China, Japan, and the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I want to point out to folks that Jürgen Randers, one of the authors of The Limits to Growth back in 72, has just put out a new book called World Projections, I think 2052, in which he looks again at those issues. And I will be having him on the show in the near future. I'm going to read another quote of yours, and then we're going to shift to the food issue. In order for markets to work over the long term and for economic actors to make sound decisions, markets must provide reliable information, including the full cost of products. But the market gives us incomplete information. As a result, we make bad decisions. The difference between the market prices for fossil fuels and an honest price that incorporates the environmental cost to society is large, huge. Is the same true for food and other resources? In other words, fossil fuels is the one we always look at, that the health costs, the pollution costs, the other sorts of costs, the climate change costs are not taken into account. And so fossil fuels remain, certainly in the U.S. and internationally, falsely priced. So the market is you feed in bad information, you get out bad decisions. My question is, fossil fuel we know about. Is that true for food and other resources or not?
It is.
Okay.
It is substantially true for food, though not quite as dramatically as with fossil fuels. We are doing a number of things today that are not sustainable. One is agriculture today is carbon intensive. But the amount of energy used to produce food is not actually all that great. We use a lot of energy to process and package and transport and market food, but the share of energy used in the food sector that's actually used on the farm is very small. I've forgotten the exact number, 15 or 18% or something like that. So it's once the commodities leave the farm gate that we begin to consume a lot of energy. The other thing I might mention is that another component of the unsustainability of the world economy, and particularly the food sector today, is that we're producing a lot of food by overpumping aquifers.
Right.
In India, for example, the World Bank estimates that 175 million people in India are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. My estimate for China is that 130 million Chinese are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. We know that in this country, we're overpumping extensively in major agricultural states like Texas and California, for example, and a number of states in between. So we're unsustainable in terms of carbon emissions. We're unsustainable in terms of water use. We're also, and incidentally, in some parts of the world, grain production is now shrinking as a result of aquifer depletion and irrigation wells going dry. The most notable area in the world is the Arab Middle East, countries like Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon. Those countries as a group are experiencing a very steady and not so slow decline in their grain production because their irrigation wells are going dry. The most dramatic of these is Saudi Arabia, which for 30 years was self-sufficient in wheat. Saudi Arabia has roughly 30 million people, about the same as Canada. But the Saudis were pumping this very substantial underground aquifer, which was largely a fossil aquifer, which means it does not naturally replenish from rainfall. So once you pump it out, that's it. It's like pumping oil. When it's gone, it's gone. And so the Saudis went from self-sufficiency in wheat production and to something like a 70% drop over the last 2 or 3 years. And within another year or two, they'll be out of the wheat production business entirely and totally dependent on imports. Okay. So we're for the first time seeing not just a country, but a group of countries where grain production is declining because of aquifer depletion.
I want to go into what you were just talking about, the aquifer situation, the fossil aquifer situation, just a little more to really bring that out in so people can see it in their mind's eye, if you will. One way we get water is rainfall. The other way we get water is from aquifers.
And the third way is from rivers, damming rivers and or pumping water from rivers to use for irrigation.
Very good. Now, we know that we're going to talk about droughts and what that's doing and the relationship between climate change and droughts and so on. But this notion of aquifers, as I said earlier, there was a period where we used only as much as could be replenished each year in terms of all resources, and that has changed over the last 40 years. Aquifers, explain again for people the two different types of aquifers and the impact of the use of those two different types of aquifers. Just spell that out a little more, because I think this may be a new concept to some people.
Right. Most aquifers are replenishable. That is, these are underground water layers, if you will, that are replenished by rainfall. And most aquifers are actually sort of underground rivers. The water moves very slowly through those aquifers. For example, in the United States, water from the Rocky Mountains coming eastward goes into what's the Western Plains and recharges aquifers there. So most aquifers are replenished by rainfall. So you can keep pumping them as long as you want, as long as you don't pump faster than the recharge rate. The other kind of aquifer is what we call fossil aquifers. These are aquifers that where the water was put down eons ago in geological time, and then it was trapped there. And so it's just been there for, you know, ages. And we can now pump those. And one of the most important fossil aquifers in the world is the Ogallala Aquifer, which is an aquifer in the western Great Plains of the U.S. It starts in Nebraska, comes down through Kansas, catches a bit of eastern Colorado, and then down into the Oklahoma and the Texas Panhandle. That aquifer is essentially a fossil aquifer, and it is an important source of irrigation water in the United States. If you fly across the U.S. or fly from Washington to Denver, for example, you see these circles, these crop circles, and what they are is the reason they're circular is because they're sent pivot irrigation systems. In the center of each of those circles is a well, and that well is pumping water for irrigation, and the center pivot system just gradually moves around in a circle. Those are the two types of aquifers. So when the Ogallala Aquifer is eventually depleted, those wells will go dry.
And that area that we depend on so greatly for grain in the United States will. I suppose there will still be some rainfall, but it will not be irrigated by the aquifer that has basically sustained it all this time.
Right. Yeah. So what farmers will do in most cases is go back to dry land farming, and that means either lower wheat yields or maybe replacing corn with wheat, which has a much lower yield. The other major fossil aquifer in the world is the deep aquifer under the North China Plain. And just to describe the North China Plain, it's a big chunk of the eastern coast of China, and it produces most of the country's wheat and corn. And that aquifer is being heavily overpumped and will eventually go dry. Indeed, some of the wells are already going dry. So the two big fossil aquifers in the world are the Ogallala Aquifer in the United States and the aquifer under the northern plain of China. These two countries happen to be the world's two leading grain producers. There's no other country close to them. The U.S. and China are both over 400 million tons of grain per year. India, which is number three, is down just over 200 million tons per year. So what happens to the water resources in the United States and in China obviously will affect the world grain supply and, indeed, the world price of food.
Okay. You say that food is the most likely system to break first. Now, when you say food, are you actually referring to some of the things we've just been talking about, which is water, soil, and population?
Right. We've been able to expand food production dramatically since the end of World War II. We've tripled grain yields from 1950 to 2010, and that's a combination of fertilizer, higher yield varieties, irrigation, etc. But we've now reached a point where we can't expand the irrigated area anymore. Indeed, it's going to shrink somewhat in the years ahead. We can't use more fertilizer. We're now using, we sort of maxed out with fertilizer use, and they even have gone further than we should. And we've developed high-yielding varieties of all, you know, whether the dwarf wheats and rices or hybrid corn, we've done all that. So the problem is there aren't many things that we can think of that we need to do now, or that we can do now. We've done almost everything we can think of to raise yields and to raise production. So we're moving into a period which is going to be a very slow period in world agricultural growth at a time when we're still adding 80 million people a year. And that 80 million per year means there will be 219,000 people at the dinner table tonight who were not there last night.
So just so people hear that, that means almost a quarter of a million people,
right,
each day.
That's two Rose Bowls filled with people.
Yeah. Each day. I mean, I don't think I had ever, maybe I've seen that number before, but I don't think I'd ever pictured it quite like that. Every day.
It's
and,
relentless.
Yeah. You say farmers are facing new challenges on both sides of the food equation, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking, as I do usually about once a year, with Lester Brown. He's the founder of World Watch and the Earth Policy Institute. He's the author most recently of Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. And you can learn more about all of his work, and they have a lot of free information to download up there at earth-policy.org. So you say farmers face challenges on both sides of the food equation. That's the demand side, which we were just talking about in terms of population growth. But there's another factor, isn't there, and that is consumers moving up the food chain.
There are probably something like 3 billion people in the world today who are moving up the food chain as incomes permit, consuming more grain-intensive livestock products. And that can be huge. Just to give you an idea of the sort of the range of the food chain, in India today, India being a low-income country, grain consumption is about 400 pounds per person per year, or just over a pound a day. When you have only a pound of grain per day, you can't afford to convert much of that into animal protein. You have to consume almost all of it directly. But in the United States, we consume about 1,600 pounds of grain per year, or 4 pounds a day. But of that 1,600 pounds, only about 200 pounds is consumed directly as bread, pasta, breakfast cereals, and so forth. The other 1,400 pounds is consumed indirectly in the form of meat, milk, eggs, cheese, yogurt, ice cream, all those good things. In fact, most of the things in your refrigerator are products of converting grain into animal protein.
And so what's happening is, as India, as China, as other countries around the world move up the economic chain, they move up the food chain. They begin desiring and having the ability to purchase more meat, which, as you've just demonstrated, is a much more intensive demand on the world's ability to produce grain.
Right. Just to give you an idea, China's total meat consumption surpassed that of the United States in, something like 1994. But today, China's total meat consumption is double that of the United States.
Wow. I had no idea.
Their per capita is still only half of ours, but the basic point is we have a large chunk of the world, 1.35 billion people now, moving up the food chain at a rate that we've not actually seen before.
Okay. And what about biofuels? In 2011, the U.S. harvested 400 million tons of grain, and of this, 127 million tons, that's a third of it, went to ethanol. Is that still, are we still at that pace, or have we realized the error of these ways?
Well, there's growing opposition to using grain to produce fuel for cars. It's true in Europe, it's here, and it's a widely held position throughout the world. We have seen in the last few months, with very high corn prices, some of these distilleries converting grain, mostly corn, into fuel for cars, have actually closed because it's become unprofitable. So there's been a drop in the use of grain to produce fuel in the U.S. of about 10%. If you were going to build a plant today, I mean, if you were thinking about building a new plant, once you looked at the economics, you wouldn't do it. But if you already have a plant built, so you're only faced with operating costs, then you might still be able to get by, but just barely, in converting $8 a bushel corn into fuel for cars. And if the price of oil were to drop somewhat, and the price of gasoline were to drop from, say, close to $4 to $3, then it would be very difficult for the ethanol distilleries to keep producing and to make a profit.
You know, one of the things that I think, as we also can point to, is that the economic crisis, 2007-2008, which we're still dealing with, actually had some good effects in this regard, right? In other words, some of the trends that were have slowed down. But the question is whether population will cancel out any of those, and whether, if the economy returns, we'll have learned any lessons along the way.
There are a number of trends at work now that are reducing our consumption demands in the U.S. Incidentally, we talked about the younger generation not being part of the car culture, and so they're not buying cars in the same way they socialize over the Internet. But we also have an interesting shift toward bicycles and away from cars. And that's partly because the average college student graduating today, as I remember, has a debt of something like $65,000 to pay off. So most young people out of college are not buying cars the way earlier generations did. And this is changing or contributing to a change in lifestyles. I mean, it's interesting that there are now 26 cities in this country, including Washington, D.C., that have bike-sharing programs. The one in D.C. is the largest and the most successful to date. And it's been amazing to see how these racks of bikes around town you can just pick up with your credit card and use are being used by so many people.
It's one thing that I must point out, Lester, is that one of the cities that has been least hit by the economic recession is Washington, D.C. partly because it's high tech, partly because it's government. But and so that bike sharing would be as strong as it is in a city that has not suffered the worst of the economic recession is a, sort of a doubly good news.
It is. And we're now about to see two of the largest cities in the country launch bike sharing programs, namely New York City and Chicago. Mayor Bloomberg's program, I think, will be operational by the end of December. If not before, it will be 10,000 bikes in New York for people to use in this bike sharing program. The other city is Chicago, where Rahm Emanuel actually hired away the D.C. bike share program director and got him out to Chicago to do the same thing there that he did here. So this is not just a trivial thing anymore. I mean, it's happening in cities across the country, including some of the biggest cities.
One thing I've read in your work is you talk about a fellow wearing a T-shirt that says, "I lost 3,500 pounds, you know, ask me how." And of course, the way he did was he dumped his car and replaced it with a bike.
Right. huge resource savings.
Oh, right. Because of the weight.
We think about gasoline use, but the amount of energy goes into the steel and all the things in manufacturing a car are huge.
Yeah, 3,500 pounds versus a bike is about 22 pounds.
Right.
I'm going to mention one statistic. You've got a lot of, you know, powerful statistics in here that just puts a personal face on some of what we've been talking about. And then I want to talk about climate and climate change. So we're not going to follow up on this one. But as a result of chronic hunger, 48%, that's one out of two children in India, are undersized, underweight, and likely to have IQs that are on average 10 to 15 points lower than those of well-nourished children. So that's just to put a face, and it isn't just that personal face of the child itself, but we depend on the minds and the brains and the creativity of children to create the future. And as we produce in a country like India, half of all children with an average IQ drop of 10 to 15 points because of chronic hunger, we are missing the creativity and the advances that those children and millions around the world who are suffering from chronic hunger could provide us. I just want to point that out.
This is sometimes referred to as the lost generation.
Yeah. And I know other folks, you know, folks who are positive. I remember Peter Diamandis, whose book is Abundance, and he basically says the future is better than you think it is. One of his key drivers of a positive future is the creativity of these, you know, millions of young people that are, if you will, coming online. You know, they're getting their mobile phones, they're getting access to online. They now become players in the creativity of the world. But this other trend of chronic hunger reducing their capacity, you know, has to be reckoned with as well. I wanted to talk about climate change. Let me read, first of all, a very specific statistic, which is just having to do with the droughts in America, and then talk about the broader picture. You tell us that in May, the U.S. Department of Agriculture estimated that the 2012 U.S. corn yield would be enormous and that it might be the record-breaking yield. But then as the drought hit, they retracted that and moved way back on it. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, in May, it was clear that we had planted more corn in this country, I think, than at any time in history. It was a huge crop that we were looking forward to this fall. And it turned out it was unusually warm in late March and April, early May, and in the Midwest and the northern Great Plains. So it was great for planting corn, and things looked really good at the beginning. And then came the drought, and with each passing week, as USDA made estimates of this year's crop, the corn crop began to shrink, and for, I don't know, 8 or 10 weeks in a row, the estimated yield per acre just dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. And we got to fall, and we realized we didn't have a very good corn crop at all, that heat and drought had done an enormous amount of damage. And the thing about corn, incidentally, is that corn during the pollination period is particularly vulnerable to heat because for pollination to occur, the pollen must fall from the tassel, which is at the top of the corn plant, down to the silk strands that come out the end of the ear, the sort of the nuisance factor when you're doing corn on the cob.
Right.
Silk. Each of those silk strands is attached to a kernel site. And in order for a kernel to develop, a grain of pollen must fall on the end of the corn, where the silk comes out and travel down to the kernel site. It's like a fallopian tube. So anyhow, corn can be very vulnerable to intense heat during that pollination period. And that's part of what happened this year, and we ended up with a crop just far less than we had expected.
Now, here's something that I think makes things very dramatic, and this is about photosynthesis. You write that as the temperature rises, as a rule, as the temperature rises to 68 degrees Fahrenheit, photosynthesis increases from 68 to 90. So this is as springtime comes. From 68 to 95 degrees, it remains steady. Beyond this, it declines fast, and at 104 degrees, photosynthesis ceases entirely. Talk a bit about that and what we saw this summer, for instance.
Well, what we saw was exactly this scenario unfolding. And, basically the corn crop with this record heat that we had during the summer went into thermal shock. And so the yields were just in contrast to back in May when everything looked so good. By midsummer, it was clear we weren't going to have a very good corn crop. And in the end, we lost a large share of it.
I was talking in terms of Fahrenheit, but I see another powerful statistic you have here. For each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature above the optimum during the growing season, farmers can expect, hear this, 1 degree rise in Celsius, 10% decline in grain yield. And a 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature in the U.S. reduces yields 17%. So this drought and this enormous heat that we had this summer, and that we're having over and over again is and again, remember, we're talking about population growth. We're talking about people moving up the food chain. We're talking about aquifers drying up. And we're talking about then we add on to it this temperature change. And what you've pointed out is that temperatures rise and fall over decades, over centuries, and so on. And so you have agriculture is used to a bad season, a good season, a bad season, a good season. Climate change is different. In other words, once we move in a certain direction, that may not be cyclical anymore. It may be the new normal. And that's really something that we have to deal with. It's an enormous player in this whole food crisis, isn't it?
It is. I myself was a farmer almost 60 years ago now, and we knew, every once in a while we'd have a bad year. The rainfall wasn't good, or it was too hot, or whatever. But it happened just once in a while, and we could always count on things going back to normal the next year. But now, with the world's climate system in constant flux and change, there's no norm to go back to. So farmers on the land today simply don't know what to expect from one year to another, because it's all in flux, and that's a difficult situation to be in.
And one of the things that we did with the Agriculture Department, if I'm not mistaken, was it was set up to take care of those cyclical changes, but it is not set up to deal with permanent change.
Right. And related to that, during the last half of the last century, was most of that time, we were in a surplus situation. The big problem, young people can't remember this, but those of us who were around back then remember that surpluses were sort of the negative side of agriculture, because we're just producing more than the world market could absorb. And we eventually started paying farmers not to produce on part of their land, or not to produce on part of the land to be eligible for price support.
Right.
Now, you know, we're flat out, and we couldn't produce any more than we now are if we wanted to. And it's interesting because the world is so dependent on us. I mean, we do have an exceptional piece of agricultural real estate in this country, particularly in the U.S. Midwest. For example, the state of Iowa produces more grain than Canada.
Wow.
And the state of Iowa is now challenging China in soybean production at the same time. So the U.S. Midwest is really an exceptional piece of farmland, and we're fortunate to have it. That's why we supply most of the world's grain exports and its soybean exports as well.
I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Lester Brown. We're talking about his book, Full Planet, Empty Plates. You can learn more at earth-policy.org. Let's turn to the last chapter of your book, Can We Prevent a Food Breakdown?, in which you sort of point the way forward. What do we do to deal with this on the macro scale and then as individuals?
Well, the most important thing on the are to stabilize population, to stabilize climate. The population part is relatively easy. There are millions of women in the world today who want to plan their families, but who do not have access to family planning services. We can't afford that family planning gap. Filling it would cost peanuts. I mean, it would be such a small amount, making sure that women everywhere have access to reproductive health care. It is such a small amount that it would get lost in the rounding of our defense budget. We can't afford to have women who want to plan their families not have access to family planning service. That's number one. Number two is we've got to move quickly to stabilize climate, or it will spiral out of control. And to do that, we're going to have to cut carbon emissions fast. And I don't mean cutting them 80% by 2050. The game will be over long before that. But cutting them 80% by 2020. And that really requires something more like a World War II restructuring of the U.S. Economy. Remember, in World War II, in 1942, this is after December 7, 1941, we totally restructured the U.S. industrial economy. President Roosevelt banned the production of cars. All the automobile companies, all their assembly plants switched to tanks and planes. And we sort of overwhelmed the world with our arms production. I mean, it was extraordinary to see how we could do that. We now need to begin thinking about doing the same thing in the world energy economy. Really pull out the stops to develop our wind and solar and geothermal energy resources and move as quick away from coal and oil as rapidly as we can.
Okay. Those are the two big ones. Let me ask one quick question on that. I've been pointing more and more lately to America's inability to see what happens in other countries. In other words, the energy efficiency and the moving away from for some of these carbon-intensive forms of energy in Japan, in Germany, is so far ahead of us. And yet here, we're recording this interview after the second presidential debate. And in that debate, the two candidates of the major parties were, for the most part, while Obama said he was more interested in the fuels of the future, the energies of the future, the industries of the future, both of them were basically, I'll do natural gas, I'll do coal. Why is it we can't see that a country like Germany has made different decisions that have worked out very well for it?
It's worked out very well for Germany. Their wind resources, there are three states in northern Germany that now get between 40 and 60% of their electricity from wind. They've really pulled out the stops on solar cells, and this is not this is not California where you have bright sunlight all the time, but they've made it work.
And also they are, as I point out frequently on this show, they are, depending on currency evaluations, they are either the number one or the number two exporting country in the world. They're not sacrificing productivity for this, and they're a country of only 83 million people. Yet here we seem I would venture that most people in America don't know what we just said.
I think that's true, and even fewer know how China is pushing wind energy. I mean, the idea that they have 8 wind mega complexes under construction now, which will each have at least 20,000 megawatts of generating capacity. Think 20 nuclear power plants. The largest in Inner Mongolia will have 38,000 megawatts of generating capacity, which is enough to satisfy the needs of a country like Poland. I mean, China is thinking big on wind, and we're falling further and further behind on this front.
You know, we've often talked, Lester, about this idea that we need a World War II type of mobilization. And I was thinking, just as you were saying it today, that the economy, the world economy and the U.S. economy were in trouble. We had not totally come out of the Depression at the point at which that turnaround happened. So, in other words, if someone were to say, well, we got to wait till things get better before we can make that kind of a change, you know, you hear what I'm saying. And what we did was it was great for our economy, and it was that decision, I would say, that propelled America into its most productive period, World War II, the 50s, the 60s. It's exactly what we need, not just for the good of the world, but for us to become that creative, innovative driver again that we were just saying China is aiming to be, Germany is aiming to be. Let me just ask about a couple of other things that you point out in your last chapter. We have to cancel biofuel mandates. That's what we were talking about before with ethanol and biofuel. Mm-hmm. And also, you said we need to restructure the tax system.
Right. In order to get the market to tell the truth, when we buy a gallon of gasoline, we pay the cost of pumping the oil, refining in the gasoline, getting the gasoline to the local service station. We don't pay the cost of the climate change from burning that gallon of gasoline. So we need to restructure our tax system to get the market to tell the truth so that the price of gasoline reflects both the direct cost of producing it, but also the indirect cost of climate change and what that does, for example, to the world food economy. So we've got to do some big picture thinking here and get our act together, or we could be in serious trouble.
And I'm just going to read a few lines from the very end of the book. We all need to select an issue and go to work on it. Find some friends who share your concern. Get to work. The overriding priority is redefining security and reallocating fiscal resources. If your major concern is population growth, join one of the international-oriented groups. We can prevent a breakdown of the food system, but it will require a huge political effort undertaken on many fronts and with a fierce sense of urgency. The book is Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity, and the website is earth-policy.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at my website and at iTunes. And my website, it goes by two names, terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or a world that just might work, one word, .com. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement that tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and gives you actually some pretty valuable background, even if you miss the show, I usually have 2 or 3 articles in there that'll tell you what's going on. You can sign up at my website or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com. Thank you to Lester Brown. As always, keep up the good work.
My pleasure.
Very good.